This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. The Lusitania is a name familiar to many of us from high school history class. A luxury British ocean liner, on May 1st, 1915, she departed New York City with nearly 2,000 souls on board, including 189 Americans. The destination was Liverpool. The Great War, World War I, was underway. The U.S. was not yet involved, but the Lusitania departed despite a warning from the German embassy that vessels flying the flag of Great Britain or of any of her allies were liable to destruction. The Lusitania never made it. Sunk by a German U-boat off the coast of Ireland, nearly 1,200 perished, including a husband and wife from Philadelphia and their six children. Only the body of the baby was found. Eric Larson tells the story of the Lusitania in his book Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Dead Wake is narrative nonfiction, and in it, Larson uses considerable research to bring to life the story of the Lusitania, the captains, the crews, the chase, the sinking. Also, Woodrow Wilson, Winston Churchill, something called The Room of 40, and portraits of many of the passengers. So, Eric Larson, so great to have you on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
If you would, let's begin with the description of this beautiful transatlantic Greyhound, as she was called.
Yeah, the Lusitania at this point was the fastest, biggest, most glamorous ocean liner in service. And that's a very important qualification because there were bigger ships, possibly faster ships, especially some of the great German liners. But all the German liners had been essentially interned in neutral ports because Germany did not want them seized by the British Navy and turned into weapons against their own Navy. And the British were using a lot of their bigger liners, as troop transports and also as so-called armed cruisers.
She was beautiful, but she wasn't perfect.
Well, nothing's perfect, right? Mm. But the ship was, I mean, outwardly, the Lusitania, you know, it was if you remember the movie Titanic, I mean, it was just a beautiful ship, you know, really sleek lines, these immense funnels. Just looked like, even when the ship was still, it looked like it was moving at a high rate of speed. But, you know, the ship also sort of masked the fundamental realities. The outward design masked the fundamental realities of ships of that era, and that is that they were powered by steam engines. And you know, this required vast amounts of coal shoveled into furnaces down in the core of this ship. So down there, it was like some scene from a coal mine in Tennessee, whereas the rest of the ship was just elegance, you know, personified, except maybe in third class. Mm.
So tell us about Captain William Thomas Turner.
Yeah, Captain Turner was I really liked Captain Turner. I think that if I'd gone aboard the ship that day, the day it departed, you know, May 1, 1915, if I'd gone aboard and I'd encountered Turner, I would have felt even more at ease, you know. It's kind of like when you get. I don't know about you, but I don't care that much for flying, and so I listen very carefully to the pilot's voice, right? And so if the pilot's voice is like, you know, Robert Stack or something like that, I'm cool, right? I'm fine. I know I'm in good hands. But you know, if it's like Woody Allen, forget it. I'm getting off that plane. And I think that Captain Turner was sort of in the Robert Stack category. Mm-hmm. Didn't say a lot. You know, he just evoked absolute competence.
He was experienced.
Very experienced. Yeah. And that was key. He was very, very experienced.
Not fond of the social piece of things.
Not at all fond of the social piece of things.
What did he call some of his passengers?
Well, in a conversation with his beloved housekeeper companion, he referred to them as bloody monkeys. Hmm. So, and actually, you know, he and I recognized that he was not that fond of the whole social side of things. So a so-called staff captain, sort of a second captain, was assigned to the ship, and it was his responsibility to be essentially the social director as well as, you know, operational duties.
And Eric Larson, if you would, let's get a sense of the passengers on board. Could you read a few paragraphs from your book, Dead Wake?
Clothes.
Yes.
Yeah, this is before departure. So they brought their best clothes, and in some cases, their only clothes. The dominant palette was black and gray. There were cheerier items as well. A heliotrope and white check frock, a boy's red knitted jacket with white buttons, a green velveteen belt. Babies complicated things. Their clothing was intricate. A single outfit for one infant boy consisted of a white wool wrapper, a white cotton bodice edged with red and blue piping, overalls of blue cotton embroidered with dotted squares, plaited down the front, fastened in back with white buttons, a gray wool jacket with four ivory buttons, black stockings, and shoes with straps. He topped this off with a sucking tube or pacifier tied around his neck with cord. The wealthiest passengers carried rings, brooches, pendants, necklaces, and necklets embedded with diamonds, sapphires, rubies, and onyx, and sardonyx, its red sister. They brought bonds and notes and letters of introduction, but also cash. A 35-year-old woman brought five $100 bills, another 1150s. Everyone seemed to carry a watch, invariably in a gold case. One woman brought her Geneva-made Raymond III Cylindre 10 Rubis Medaille d'Or number 220063, gold but with a face the color of blood. Later, the serial numbers of these watches would prove invaluable.
So where did you – how did your research help you turn up this information?
Well, so the unfortunate thing is we know about, for example, the boy who had this very complicated clothing, he was one of the victims who did not make it, and he was washed ashore essentially wearing all of this clothes, and Cunard very carefully cataloged everything that people were wearing, all their personal effects, because like in this case, this boy was unidentified ultimately, and they wanted to have all this material available so that if at some point after this poor child is buried, if at some point somebody recognizes some element of the clothing, that there might be an identification coming. So, but knowing that this is how he ended up, you know also that he happened to have this aboard. So that's the kind of detective work that I like to do.
And there were different classes, in quotation,
different classes,
marks on,
three classes.
On board.
Yeah. It was first class, which of course was the wealthy class. The most luxurious, yeah. Although notably, one of the passengers, I like this too because it's like how times change. One of the passengers traveling in first class was a bookseller, Charles Laureat, famous the world over. You know, who knew? Who knew, right, that a bookstore owner could actually be famous enough to, be known on both sides of the Atlantic and travel first class? This is great. But there was first class, there was second class, which was on the Lusitania, was considered by many to be the equal of first on other ships. And then there was third class, or they called it immigrant class, which was actually also very good on the Lusitania because there was a lot of competition for the immigrant market. While in the past, there were some pretty Neanderthal conditions on ships. In this case, it was comfortable, decent food, not first class food, but decent.
So you kind of cut back and forth in this book between the Lusitania and the German U-boat.
Right.
You paint a picture of life on the U-boat. First, who was Captain Walther Schwieger?
Yep.
Who was he?
Well, so when I set out to do this book, the thing that made me kind of decide I wanted to do this book was when I realized that this captain had left a very detailed narrative of his entire patrol, his war log, his official war log. And it was not some little statistical thing with lots of, positions and weather and so forth. It had actual narrative of the voyage. And that's what persuaded me that I could make this a suspense narrative because I knew where he was at all times and I knew where the Lusitania was. And if you know that and you cut back and forth, you've got suspense right there. Mm-hmm. But, I was expecting, though – I guess I was sort of hoping that the captain of the submarine would be this, this absolutely evil Max von Sydow character, with a scar down his face and all this stuff. And I didn't get it. What I got was this charming 30-year-old guy, blue eyes, handsome. His crew loved him. He was funny. He was warm. At one point, he had six dogs aboard. Six dachshunds aboard a submarine, yeah.
Where do you put six dachshunds on a submarine?
Where do you put anything aboard a submarine? It was very interesting. Well, he had some interesting things aboard that submarine at different times as well. But what that really did for me, it really made me decide that, okay, I'm going to, I love nuance in history. You can't make a hero out of somebody who's not. You can't make a villain out of somebody who's not. And so I just decided to really try to capture life on the submarine,
They were called iron coffins.
Well, iron coffins is one way to put it. Yeah. And so I just love the idea of trying to humanize these guys. They were just out there doing a job, They were living a really sort of miserable life, and actually this patrol was a miserable experience for everybody.
So you're careful to chronicle and not necessarily take sides in the telling of this story.
I don't take sides. It's totally unfair to try to judge the past, especially with contemporary knowledge.
So just back from briefly to the submarine and what it was like for life, what life was like for the men inside this, you know, again, what they called the iron coffin. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I try to picture this. I mean, you know, first of all, the submarine had it was obviously very cramped. It carried 36 men who day in, day out wore the same leather, you know, waterproof clothing, never bathed because what was the point? They had one lavatory, and that was at certain depths was not functional because you couldn't flush it because the pressures had to be less in order to achieve what you wanted to achieve. You had to deal with cooking smells. You had to deal with condensation on the inside of the hull. And interestingly, when the submarine was in fact submerged for prolonged periods of time, which by the way was not something that those submarines were meant to do. I mean, they were meant to be submerged, but not for long periods. But if they had to be, say, to evade destroyers, they got very hot. They got very hot, and temperatures could rise to as much as 100 degrees in that cramped, you know, in that cramped cylinder. So not a place for anybody with claustrophobia.
So what was the mission of Captain Schwieger? What was he looking for? He was hunting for big game.
Well, Schwieger was hunting for any game. He set out from Germany. They were looking actually for troop transports. One of the ironies is that there was something that British intelligence did. They set up a ruse, and that's what launched a bunch of submarines from Germany, and this was one of them, U-2. So they were out to try to intercept very large troop transports that might be participating in what this rumor had planted, that might have been an amphibious invasion of Germany. There was no such invasion planned, but the rumor was spread with the idea that maybe Germany would have to move troops from the front lines in France to defend the shores of Germany. So this special sortie of submarines set out to intercept these armed troop transports.
And at the same time, or approximately the same time, the Lusitania was preparing to set sail,
right,
despite the fact that there was a warning from the German embassy not
right.
to do so.
Now, the warning was not directed specifically at the Lusitania, but the timing made a lot of people think that it might have been. In fact, it was a coincidence that this message had been in the newspapers in the morning on the shipping pages of the New York newspapers, saying that anybody, not just British citizens and not just British ships, anybody who entered the war zone was at risk because, you know, mistakes happen and so forth.
And we'll talk about why the captain decided to go after the break. We're talking with author Eric Larson on Radio Times. He is a former journalist whose latest novel of narrative nonfiction brings to life the last voyage of the Lusitania in 1915. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in this hour for Marty Moskowane. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. Our author Eric Larson joins us this hour. His book is called Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, if you've got a question or comment, the number is 888-477-9499, or you can send us an email at radiotimes at whyy.org. A tweet works as well at whyy Radio Times. So going into the break, we were going to talk about why Captain William Turner decided to set sail on May 1st of 1915, despite the warning from the German embassy. But before we go there, let's talk about something called Room 40, its connection to the British Admiralty. What did they know when all this was going on? And then we'll get to Captain Turner.
Yeah, Room 40 was an amazing operation. And it was set up very early in the war by Churchill and a handful of others. Churchill, by the way, was at this point First Lord of the Admiralty. That is the top guy in the Admiralty. And what had happened is, sort of miraculously, the British had come into the possession of the three most important code books used by the German Navy. Had come into possession of things by some really quite remarkable means. just totally fluky. And these gave them the power to essentially read all the wireless communications between the German Navy, German naval headquarters, bases and ships and submarines and so forth. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than simply reading. You had to intercept and then decode and decipher. But the fact is they were able to do this. And what's so compelling about this Room 40, well, first of all, it was top secret. Only a handful of people knew about this. And there was a big effort to maintain the secrecy of this entity. Which is interesting because you know, things that they intercepted that they could have acted on, they did not, because they did not want to betray the secret. They were waiting for big things to before they would reveal, you know, before they would act on the intelligence that they gathered. However, one of the things that they intercepted was a message from the captain of U-20, U-2 being the band, U-20, Captain Schwieger. It was actually a message to him that set out exactly the patrol zone where he was supposed to end up on this journey from Germany. He was supposed to leave Germany, go over the north of the British Isles, over Scotland, because that was safer for him. The English Channel was very dangerous at this point for submarines. He was to go over the north of Scotland and come down the west side of Ireland and eventually wind up in a position right off the mouth of the Mersey River at Liverpool, which is where all the Cunard liners, all the civilian liners came through. Hmm. They knew this without a doubt that that is where this captain was going to be stationed. And not only that, they knew a lot about this captain because they had tracked U-20 before. They knew that he was a submarine ace. He was a proven killer of ships. So there he was going to be, right off Liverpool. They did not reveal this to anybody outside Room 40.
So what conclusion would you draw then? This is aimed at the Lusitania. So should the Lusitania...
Well, he was not hunting the Lusitania per se. He was to be stationed off the mouth of the Mersey at Liverpool, which is where all the ships come through.
But Room 40 knew this.
Room 40 knew this.
And they knew that the Lusitania could well be in danger.
Well, they knew beyond doubt, of course, that the Lusitania was coming because at this point, everybody knew the Lusitania was coming. This was like top of mind in part because of the German warning, which made the press in the U.S. and abroad. But Room 40 also knew that nightly at midnight, the big German naval transmitter at Norddeich was transmitting the comings and goings of Cunard liners, including the Lusitania. So there's no mystery here that there was a ship, giant Lusitania, was coming to Liverpool and that there was a submarine waiting, you know. So fascinating.
Well, was the information imported to the Lusitania?
No, none of it was.
And why not?
Good question. That will remain, I think, forever a mystery, but it may well have something to do with, well, A, the desire to protect the secrecy of Room 40, B, and probably more to the point, the speculation that there was some value in having the Lusitania be attacked in the Irish Sea in terms of potentially getting America into the war. There's always been speculation that that's what Churchill would have loved. Now, there is no question that Churchill would have loved for America to get into the war because of some incident occurring, because he said as much in a letter to the Board of Trade chairman in Britain. He said, and I'm paraphrasing this rather badly, but he said that, you know, we need all the traffic we can get from America, and if some of it gets into trouble, all the better.
Gets into trouble.
He wanted better. Now, whether he had a role in, you know, what ultimately happened, there's always been speculation that, you know, he was the architect of this thing because there would be a broader, longer-term benefit. But there is no smoking memo. There's nothing that absolutely proves that. But we can talk a little bit more about that.
It's hard to extrapolate whether he actually would have included the sinking of a passenger liner and losing all those men, women, and children.
Right. Although, caveat here. I love Churchill as a historical character. I think he is one of the most fascinating men ever to walk the earth. He was utterly ruthless. He was ruthless.
And at the end of the day, despite what we kind of glean from our history books, the sinking of the Lusitania did not immediately lead to United States involvement in World War I.
Did not. And this is one of the things that also drew me to work on the book, because I was so surprised by that. Because, you know, like everybody else who went through high school, you know, the high school timeline, there's the Lusitania sinks and boom, we're in the war. It's like the World War I equivalent of Pearl Harbor. At least that's what we're taught. Mm. And, you know, it's funny. When I was doing the research for my book, I would ask friends who knew what I was working on, so give me your gut. You know, how long do you think it was between the time the Lusitania was sunk and the time America got into the war? And the estimates ranged from 2 days to 2 months. In fact, it was two full years. And when Churchill asked for a declaration of war from Congress, or to be more accurate, a declaration that a state of war already existed between Germany and the U.S., he never mentioned the Lusitania because so many other things had happened.
We are chatting with author Eric Larson this hour of Radio Times. His book is called Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. And as always, if you've got a question or comment, the number to call is 888-477-9499. If you'd like to send us an email, that works, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So let's get to Captain Turner.
Yep.
Why did he decide to leave New York May 1st of 1915 despite the warning in the newspaper that day from the German embassy? What were his thoughts?
Well, so the question decide, I mean, it's not a relevant verb because it never occurred to him not to, you know, never occurred to him not to sail. He was that kind of captain. And he believed that Lusitania was too big and too fast to ever be caught by a German submarine, you know. And there's something in that. I mean, you know, the Lusitania was very fast. Now, we should talk about why it was not going to travel as fast as usual on this voyage, because that was very important. But nonetheless, it as it crossed the Atlantic, as it arrived in Ireland, it was, it was doing about 21 knots, which is quite fast for a ship. The maximum speed that this submarine could do underwater was 9 knots. So there's reason to doubt the ability of a submarine to catch and then target and successfully sink a ship like the Lusitania. But to some extent, that was diluted thinking held over from the past. Also, I think Turner was, Turner represented the old school of mariner who came up through the ranks at a time when the rules of maritime warfare were very strict about how you treated civilians. You under no circumstances were allowed to sink a passenger liner. If you attacked a civilian cargo liner, you first had to make every effort to ensure that the crew was safe, either off the boat or take them into a prize port, as it were, at which point the fate of the ship would be determined by a prize court. These were very specific, very precise rules that had been in place for, well over a century.
So why did the rules fly out the window?
The rules flew out the window in part because how Germany was running its share of the war, but also because of the design of the submarine. The design of the submarine really changed things, and that's because, first of all, one thing we have to realize, one thing I had to realize as I was working on this book is that at this point, the submarine was brand new. It was a novel weapon. We know it now. We know it from endless World War II movies and so forth, the sonar ping and all that stuff. And incidentally, there was no sonar in World War I. There was no pinging. We know all this now about what the submarine was like. They did not. They did not, even the German and the British navies who deployed their submarines, did not know really what role they should play, how they would work. They had very little confidence in them as offensive weapons. But this evolved over time. But what happened is, initially, Germany made sort of a half-hearted stab at following the old so-called prize rules or cruiser rules, the old civilized maritime warfare against civilian shipping. So a submarine would approach a civilian ship, maybe after firing a couple of shells across its bow, and would order the captain to come out with all his papers, his manifest, and so forth. And if there was contraband aboard, military or otherwise, he would sink it, but after first putting the crew into their lifeboats. So that was their version of following the prize rules. Problem was, Britain, which was really, really needed all the shipping it could possibly get because it's an island nation. It needed the food and needed the weapons. Mm. Began arming civilian craft.
Okay.
And also notified captains that a very effective technique against the submarine is to turn and head right toward it and ram it, because submarines were in fact very fragile. So suddenly it became very dangerous for submarine commanders to approach a ship. They also, by the way, the British began deploying what are referred to as Q ships or mystery ships, looked like an ordinary civilian cargo ship, but was in fact was full of Royal Marines and very heavily armed with guns that were hidden behind removable panels. As the submarine approached, boom! Everything, you know, it was just like a firestorm of artillery.
And you also talk about how the Submariner, the captain, really couldn't, you know, with the periscope, they couldn't really see what it was.
Very hard.
Looking for at.
But the upshot of all this was that it was unsafe for a submarine captain to approach a civilian cargo ship, and so it became much, you know, more and more the practice of sinking without warning.
Okay, so we've got some calls coming, and we're going to get to those in just a minute. But very briefly, you said that the Lusitania was not traveling as fast as she could have, which eventually led to the fateful intersection of these two ships.
A lot of things came to play on what happened that day in the Irish Sea. That was one of the things I just loved. I mean, all these fluky things, any one of which could have saved the Lusitania, but didn't. But one of the key elements of the story. Lusitania was a very, very fast ship. It had four boiler rooms. But as an economy measure, Cunard had closed down one of the boiler rooms. So the ship, instead of crossing the Atlantic at 25 or 26 knots, which is essentially 30 miles an hour, crossed at 21 knots. Now, that doesn't sound like that big a difference, you know, 4 or 5 knots. But in fact, it added an entire day to the voyage, If that ship had been traveling at maximum speed, it never would have encountered U-20 in the Irish Sea.
All right. Let's get to the phones. Rod in Reading, Pennsylvania is standing by. Welcome to Radio Times, Rod.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to mention that my beloved grandparents came over on the Lusitania on its last voyage, the first leg of its last voyage from London to New York in October of 1914. I have the trunk that all their worldly belongings were in on that voyage, and it's papered with the 1893 Bradford Telegraph Observer, still readable.
So, Eddie,
can I ask you what
color is the trunk?
Well, it's wood, bare wood on the outside, and it's very, very heavy patinaed. Okay. You know, but inside it has the label of the HMS Lusitania sailing London to New York, October 1914.
Why do you ask, Eric?
Well, it turns out that the luggage of that era was much more colorful than we think today. I mean, there's lots of color.
These were immigrants, of course, so they were an immigrant class.
I see.
So, Rod, what is your question?
I have a question. I understand that Malcolm Forbes had a collection of memorabilia from the Lusitania. And I wondered if your guest knew of that collection and could he say a few words about it if he does.
You know, I'd heard about this collection. I have not seen that collection, nor did I feel moved at all to go and examine it. So I'm the wrong person to ask about it.
Well, thank you so much
for
your call to Radio.
Can I have your trunk?
So let's kind of move again. Let's move ahead to where the two meet, the two vessels meet.
Right.
So when Captain Schwieger of the U-boat realizes that what he has in his sights is the Lusitania, what is his reaction?
Well, first of all, there's the question, does he realize that it's the Lusitania or not? Now, speculation after all of this is that, you know, how could he possibly not? He was a savvy commander. Again, everybody knew the Lusitania was coming, had a very distinctive silhouette, as they say. So I think we can all be pretty certain that he actually did recognize what it was.
Describe the day.
Well, let's see, what's very important to know about this moment is that, I mean, it's just remarkable. You know, as I said, Captain Schwieger had this horrible patrol. You know, from the moment he set out from Germany, he was dogged by bad weather, by destroyers, by malfunctioning torpedoes. 60% of German torpedoes failed during World War I. 60%. So he arrives in the Irish Sea and once again in dense fog, which is extremely dangerous for submarines. They cannot be on the surface, nor can they be at periscope depth because they could get run over by passing ships in these busy sea lanes. So he's got to be, you know, well under sea. He actually made the decision that this patrol was a failure, and that it, because of various circumstances, including fuel issues, he had made the decision to turn around and go home. Still heavy fog in the Irish Sea. Suddenly, as if the fates meant this all to happen. Suddenly, the fog lifts. Not just lifts, but lifts to yield one of the most beautiful days probably in the history of the Irish Sea. You know, May Day, warm, sunny, no clouds, suddenly no fog. The sea was as smooth as glass, no wind except for the wind imparted by the forward motion of the Lusitania, which at this point was traveling at only 18 knots. So suddenly you have this crystal clear day, which imposed a little danger also on the submarine because one of the things I was very interested to find was the submarine could not, if it was using its periscope at periscope depth, it could not stay still. It had to keep moving. And if that periscope is moving through a perfectly flat sea, it leaves a very visible wake. So there were issues on that side also. But suddenly, you know, Captain Schwieger, who has already decided to go back, but he's still on the alert for anything he can pick off on the way out. He sees this ship coming over the horizon. At first he thought it was a number of ships, but it was one giant ship. And, you know, he realizes that there's just no chance to catch it. But he decides, being an eternal optimist, he decides, well, he's gonna watch it. He's going to follow it, see what happens. Miraculously, because of what was going on board, the ship makes a turn to starboard that puts it right in his wheelhouse.
Miraculously to Schwieger, yeah.
Right. Mm. And suddenly he's got the most perfect shot that he could hope for.
So, and we're going to go to a break here in a minute, but the passengers on the Lusitania, some of them were nervous as they were approaching the Irish coast.
Yeah, well, actually, they were nervous, you know, during the voyage. You know, there was that one person said, you know, there was just endless talk about submarines and so forth. But by the time they got to the Irish Sea, not so much.
Okay, we'll pick up the story in just a moment here on Radio Times. Author Eric Larson is author of Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Phones are open, 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. And again, our guest this hour is author Eric Larson. His latest book is called Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. And again, if you've got a question or a comment, the number is 888-477-9499. Email works just as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And before we get to the actual sinking, Eric, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Woodrow Wilson, because while all this is happening, he is, you know, the war is building. He's trying to determine U.S. involvement. But you tell a side of Wilson that I think many of us don't know. He was enormously distracted at this time.
He was.
He was a romantic. He was a widower who's falling madly in love with Edith Bowling?
Edith Gault. Edith Bowling Gault. Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, he sends her all these love letters. And if you would, just take a moment to read from your book. I'd like to hear a passage.
Sure. We should note, though, that it's okay that he had a girlfriend. Because
yes,
his wife
was.
Had died in
yes.
August of 1914.
Yes.
Yes, he was a widower. So he's written to her endless letters. These are long. I'm talking about like a dozen pages, you know, with postscripts that go on for 10 pages, you know. So he's absolutely besotted with this woman. He was willing to accept friendship, he told her, for now. He writes, "If you cannot give me all that I want, what my heart finds it hard now to breathe without, it is because I am not worthy. I know instinctively you could give it if I were, and if you understood the boy's heart that is in me and the simplicity of my need, which you could fill so that all my days would be radiant." He made it clear that she would come to love him. "Do not misunderstand," he added. "What I have now at your generous hands is infinitely precious to me. It would kill me to part with it. I could not, and I hope you could not. And I will be patient without end, to see what, if anything, the future may have in store for me." Not so patient as it happened, for the next morning, Thursday, May 6, before sending off this letter, he added a codicil that was 5 pages long.
Letter writing. I'm guessing that we don't see letter writing quite like that.
No, not these days.
And eventually they did end up marrying.
But he was very distracted. And context is everything. You know, I mean, I've been actually taken to task by some, well, like maybe one or two readers who have said, "Why did you feel you had to include the girlfriend?" And because it's important. You know, this is the context. And actually, He was distracted to the point where after the Lusitania episode, when he was giving a talk in Philadelphia, he was so distracted that he actually said to, in a note to her that he had actually briefly thought he was in New York. He was just disoriented.
So did it present the potential for a dangerous distraction from the international crisis?
You know, Wilson managed to do his job very well, despite the fact that he was utterly, utterly in love. He managed to compartmentalize. I mean, obviously he was distracted by her, but who knows? Maybe in a good way. I don't know. You know, I was fascinated to find these letters.
All right, we're going.
No,
to
I'm not the first to find these letters, by the way. But I just love reading them.
We're going to get back to the actual sinking of the Lusitania in just a moment. But first, let's go to Drew in South Philly. Hello, Drew. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. How are you guys?
Well, thank you.
Good. How are you?
What's your question?
Great. First of all, Mr. Larson, I just want to say I can't wait to check out your book. I'm a huge Lusitania buff, and from what I'm hearing so far, it sounds absolutely amazing. But I had a question. I was really interested when you said as the fog lifted, U-20 was on the surface. Was that correct?
No, U-20 was not on the surface. I may have said there and misspoken.
It's all right. I was just wondering, what really made me curious was, why did they have to keep moving when the periscope was up?
Because of buoyancy. Because if they didn't keep moving, they relied on what were essentially sort of like wings at the front and back of the submarine, the planes, hydroplanes that kept the submarine level enough in order to be able to fire a torpedo. And if they stopped, they would very likely come up, right? Which would be very dangerous.
Thanks, Drew, for the call to Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks,
we appreciate it. All right, so the sinking of the Lusitania, Captain Schwieger has an idea now of what it is he's seeing. And back on the—
We think he has an idea.
We think he does.
We know he sees a very, very large vessel.
Okay, so back on the ship, and I think you documented this, I'd like to talk about a person's reacting to this impending disaster.
Yeah.
You write, the passenger, James Brooke, spotted the torpedo on what turned out to be a glorious day. The torpedo green and covered with a silvery phosphorescence. And he said, quote, it was a beautiful sight. How odd, but maybe not so much.
Well, you know, and this is why, I mean, this is why it's in the book. It was just so counterintuitive that somebody aboard ship would see this. And he saw the torpedo itself about 9 or 10 feet below the surface. The sea was so clear that day. But he was not, by the way, the only one to see this torpedo coming. So this is something that I trying to put through in my head. I mean, the whole voyage, people are nervous, you know, not super nervous. They got on the ship in the first place. But the whole voyage, people are nervous about, you know, what's going to happen. They get to the Irish Sea, 12 miles off the Irish coast, and they're feeling like they're home free. They're feeling like, you know, where was this big threat? Nothing. And then suddenly, you look off the starboard side, and there's a torpedo coming right towards your ship. It's like nobody could believe it. And one poor woman said to one of the other characters in the book. She said, and it was this sort of like you know, sad, questioning voice. She's like, is that a torpedo? And of course, it was.
So the ship is hit, and describe the scene if you would. Briefly, we have a lot of people who want to talk to you, Eric. but the scramble then to try to get on the lifeboats, the men, the women, the children, the panic, and also the calm.
Well, what happened? First of all, there was minimal panic to begin with. The salient thing to know about what happened at that point. Well, first of all, Captain Schwieger had made a mistake. He had miscalculated the speed of the Lusitania, you know, just adding to the cascade of things that happened that day. So the torpedo struck a place he did not intend. It happened to be the most perfect place he could possibly have hit. So one of the first things that happens is the ship undergoes what's referred to as forced flooding. Its engines are knocked out. Therefore, it can't stop. And if you can't stop, you can't launch lifeboats. So that's another issue. Because the day was so warm, about 70 portholes were open on the starboard side. That's an estimate. 70 portholes, and each porthole was able to would admit, if submerged, something like 3.75 tons of water in a minute, the numbers in the book, but I can't remember the specific number, but a huge amount of water. So suddenly, this ship this indestructible, giant, fast, sleek liner takes on a 25-degree list. 25 degrees, if you think about that. That's pretty incredible. 25-degree list. So what that meant was that all the lifeboats were access to all the lifeboats was impaired. Those on the port side wanted to lean in against the superstructure and were almost impossible to launch, although people tried to with disastrous result. Those on the starboard side swung out to the point where, you know, they were anywhere from 6 to 10 feet away from the ship. And if you can imagine trying to get into a lifeboat anyway when you're 60 feet above the surface of the sea, and now you realize you got to somehow get over that 8-foot gap between the hull and the lifeboat, that's a scary prospect. So this is one of the things that was happening. So, you know, many people simply opted to go into the water, you know, whether with or without a life jacket.
And at this time, Captain Schwieger is observing some of this.
Captain Schwieger is watching this. Yeah, he sees this human
reaction.
Well, he according to his war log, he expresses not remorse at all, but he expresses a sort of a horror at seeing this unfold. Now, there's some question that remorse that he, you know, applies in this that he talks about in this war log may have been added after the fact. There's some indication that that might have been the case, because, you know, no sooner does the ship sink than he sends off a message. Well, once he gets back into wireless range, he sends off a message to headquarters saying that, you know, I have sunk the Lusitania and with only one torpedo.
Yeah, and he goes on to sink another passenger ship down the road too.
Yeah, well, so. he goes on to try to sink another passenger ship, you know, and it's like this guy had no remorse.
All right, we've got more calls for you, Louise in Wayne, Pennsylvania. You're live on Radio Times. Hi, Louise.
Oh, hello. My father, Robert Twining, was the first one to be able to sink a submarine, and he won the Navy Cross for that in World War One.
Really?
And I was wondering if there was any chance that you knew the name of that submarine.
I don't. Not. I have no idea. I'm sure it was some numerical number. Twining, though, but is that any relation to the tea company?
But like 13th cousins. But
okay.
his brother, one of his brothers, Nathan Farragut Twining, went on to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Eisenhower.
Oh, really? Really? Okay.
Thank you, Louise. We appreciate it.
And the whole family was in Life magazine at one point as a military family. But
cool.
Well, we appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's go to David in Center City. Welcome, David.
I'd like to ask one question. I'm surprised you didn't address it yet. Did the Germans have specific reason to know that any armaments were on board the Lusitania, and were there any armaments aboard the Lusitania?
So now are you talking about armaments or are you talking about munitions?
Okay, munitions.
Okay, yeah, because there were no naval guns, although there was a sensational account in the 1960s that claimed that there were none. There were no naval guns. Munitions, yes, there were munitions, and Cunard was very open about it. In fact, released the manifest after the ship departed New York. There were tons and tons and tons of small arms ammunition, and also tons of essentially inert shrapnel shells, not the really dangerous part of the shells, but just parts of them. The question has always been, well, were there other secret munitions that were hidden elsewhere aboard, like high explosives, and did those contribute to the sinking? You know, two-part answer. One is, we'll never really know if there were other things aboard, if there were other things hidden, like there was a shipment of oysters, for example, and there's been speculation that, okay, oysters in May, a month without an R, you know, that's not done. So maybe that's where the high explosives were. But the second part of the answer is that no matter if there were these high explosives and so forth hidden somewhere, and there's no proof that there were, had nothing to do with the sinking. Had nothing to do with why that ship sank in 18 minutes. It was just the fluky nature of where that torpedo struck. And again, I go back to the irony that it wasn't even where Schwieger was aiming.
We appreciate the call to Radio Times. Quickly, you have to wonder about the wisdom. You mentioned earlier in the show, Britain needed munitions, but on a passenger ship, and Cunard was okay with this.
Cunard was okay with it, but everybody was shipping munitions on passenger ships and civilian ships. You know, it was okay also under neutrality laws, incredibly. You know, it was one of those little bizarre exceptions.
So as the ship is beginning its final dive, Captain Turner is in full dress uniform on the bridge.
Yes, full dress uniform, and he's wearing a life jacket.
Yeah.
And
the
ship disappears below him.
He manages to survive this.
He does survive, yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah.
Let's go on to, you write that Cunard went to great lengths to catalog and photograph the recovered bodies.
Right.
Nearly all the dead, you know, were photographed in coffins. How did you get a hold of these pictures? You describe some of the very touching, for instance, the mother holding the child.
Right.
Where did you go to get these pictures?
Well, I knew that these photographs existed because Cunard had taken them because these were the unidentified dead, and they wanted this lasting recollection, this lasting artifact in case somebody later recognized them. So I knew that the photographs existed, and I learned that they were, in fact, in the collection, Cunard Historical Archives at Liverpool, University of Liverpool. Initially, when I went there, though, and I was going through all the Cunard materials, but I asked specifically about the photographs, and they told me that I was not going to be allowed to look at them. They had decided to not make these public because of, you know, privacy issues. But then, you know, I asked, I said, well, look, you know, I came all this way and I would love to see them. Could you take my request higher up into the, you know, library hierarchy and just see if there's a way I could do it? Next day I come in and they say, well, we've decided to let you see these photographs. I was like, really? Can I ask what changed your mind? And they said, well, turns out the director loves your book, The Devil in the White City. So that was
By the way, we have a very quick question from Molly. She wants to know if is it going to be produced into a movie? Isn't pre-production happening right now?
Well, here's the thing. Leonardo DiCaprio has had the option for a long time. What recently changed is he recruited Martin Scorsese to be director. Billy Ray has written a screenplay. So things are moving along very nicely. Now, whether a film gets made or not, who knows? But it looks very positive at the moment.
And also, we've got a couple more quick questions before we wrap up here. Interestingly, the bodies of first-class American passengers, back to dead wake, of course, the so-called important passengers were given first-class treatment by the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, you know, this cut back to the whole class thing, you know? I mean, if you were important, if you were first class, you did get better treatment. Otherwise, you got a, you know, shoddy coffin and, you know, there you go.
So, Eric Larson, did you find it surprising, maybe even shocking, that the Admiralty sought to place blame for the sinking of the Lusitania on Captain Turner?
I did find it surprising. I did find it shocking because, especially given the context, I mean, you know, you would think that the propaganda value of simply letting it stand that the Germans sank the Lusitania was so huge. But instead, they turn around and during the Admiralty inquiry try to blame Captain Turner. It made no sense to this day.
What do you think?
I believe it is all part of this effort to protect Room 40. It's all part of the effort to protect Room 40 because to go into anything that would exonerate, not exonerate Turner, but it was a way of sort of masking the fact that of all the material that they knew about Room 40. You know, even actually during the Admiralty proceeding, there was testimony that suggested that there were two torpedoes. And even though the Admiralty knew full well it was one torpedo because Figger told his superiors it was one torpedo, they let it stand in the record that it was two. It was that kind of effort to keep the secrets.
Well, we've got to stop you there. Eric Larson, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times. His book is called Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. And as always, if you'd like to take a look at our Facebook page and podcasts, head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Elizabeth Fiedler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In this hour for Marty Moskowain, thank you so much for joining us.